All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in today. I am really, really excited about this episode. And so with me, we have Chief Master Sergeant Alex Udy. Good morning, Alex. How you doing?
Good, Blaze. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I know we've talked about doing this a little bit. You know, I'm really excited. I think I had the first chance to meet you on a Zoom screen probably about 3 years ago. You do have the best hair in the game. I have to, as a guy, I'm not saying I'm jealous, but
I appreciate it
either way. But I think that's only you know, of your talents. I'm excited to just talk a little bit about kind of where you kind of came from. You know, why you joined, why you stay, all that good stuff. But if you don't mind just starting off with who is Alex Udy?
Yeah. So who is Alex Udy? That's a pretty interesting question. Always been known as kind of Mr. Outgoing. You know, when I kind of look back, this is my 20th year of service. And so I look back at what am I outside of service, and thinking as a kid, always being outgoing, always being out and involved with activities with school, with drama and choir and sports and activities in the community. My family was heavily involved in different areas across
You're from Colorado, is that right?
From Colorado, yeah. So let me start. Actually, let me start there then. Yeah. So really brought up in Colorado from about age 7 through age 18 before I joined the service. And my mother and father both had a little bit of a military background. Grandparents had served in and around. One was in World War II. One had served after World War II. And then of my mother and father, my dad was a security policeman. This is before the split in security forces some years later, but in the late 70s and
Chuck
early
Norris,
80s.
I think, was security police.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So he was doing guarding of missiles in the nuke fields. My mom was actually in the Navy. She had done 6 years in cryptography and different areas of computers. And so really from early on, I would say there was this drive of family service, right? An aspect of you're always going to give something and be a part of something and serve others in some way. And so really from the time that I had grown up in Colorado, you know, it's not a really big military town other than the Air Force Academy being out in Colorado Springs. But growing up, always had retired officers is what was around. There's a lot of retired officers in and around the area there between the Springs. Buckley is now Buckley Space Base out there is a key area. And so there was some military ties and things like that. But as I was coming up through high school, always striving for that sense of adventure, you know, hiking, mountain biking, was a cross country runner, just stayed really active. And I just remember looking for like a sense of adventure really often combined with that size of service that my mom and dad talked about. So.
Now, were they talking about joining the military? Were you talking about it with them? Like, where did that, hey, I think I'm going to, you know, apply to go, you know, the route of joining the military?
I think it was probably around like age 13 or 14 because my high school had a JROTC. They had an Army JROTC that I went to a couple times and really never saw myself in academics. You know, I was never the kid that turned in homework on time, which is funny later.
Yeah, I was just saying, for those who are listening in, this is going to be interesting how, you know, you don't think something's a thing for you and then it turns around the other way. So.
Yeah, if I look at the first part of my high school upbringing and career would not lay out for what would be the rest of my life. I was like in the bottom quarter of my high school class when I graduated. So holding up the other three quarters of students so they could graduate is something my parents would always say. But yeah, probably, you know, 14, 15 knew that I just wanted to do something different. Okay. And when all of my peers, a very large high school graduating class, and this is Highlands Ranch or Littleton, Colorado, you know, of those that are going into the military, it's often that they were going to the academy. You didn't often hear of, you know, young men and women, oh, I'm signing a contract for the Army or the Marines at that time. Now, granted, you know, I graduated 2004, so it's a few years after 9/11. So there was that call to service, I think, out of several dozen of us.
Right.
Then I think that was a natural driver in a community that didn't naturally have young men and women that are like, oh yeah, I want to go ahead and serve. And so it really wasn't until about, I would say 16 or so, I realized, hey, I want to do something different. I don't want to go to college. And my grades weren't supporting, you know, an action of going to school. Had a lot of drivers, you know, behind me thinking, okay, what is it that I want? What's going to give me a sense of, hey, I want to do it. And when you're young, you want to drive fast, you want to shoot guns, you know, jump out of planes, do everything the recruiting commercials had said at the time. And so I
So special operations was already on your mind before you were even
Yes, very much so. So, you know, here I'm at, let's say, 16, 17. I remember going to the recruiter already, and my parents made a deal that they were willing to sign for me to go into the service under the DEP, the delayed entry program, because I was under 18. But they had a specific limitation saying, we're not going to sign for a combat-related job. And yet here I was so excited to sign up for the service. I went and visited with every recruiter apart from the Coast Guard because they were too far
away. That was your parents' agreement to you?
Yes. So they said, hey, we can sign for you in the delayed entry program, but we're not going to let you sign for a combat job. And it, all paths started to lead me towards the Air Force after visiting with other recruiters. And so I was looking like, well, how can I show my parents? Like, I'll show them kind of teenage attitude. I'll find something that I can get a combat job out of. And at the time, there was a path where you could join and go into the weather career field or the meteorology career field. And then after you served a first assignment of 2 to 3 years, then you could go assess to go work for, at the time I didn't know it was either going to be 18th Airborne Corps and Air Combat Command or an Air Force Special Operations Command. And so I'm reading about this information, pulling it off of, there was a website called about.com, which was kind of like an early Wikipedia open source kind
Ask
of thing.
Jeeves.
Ask Jeeves, exactly. And I remember pulling all that information off. And so there I am getting my parents to sign. They have absolutely no idea why I've chosen a high scientific job after I've taken the ASVAB, because I studied for the ASVAB, unlike the ACT or SAT. I didn't really care about that. I decided, okay, I'm going to study for the ASVAB like it is my ACT and score pretty well enough to qualify for meteorology. And then I selected as my guaranteed job. And my mother and father couldn't believe it. They're like, what the heck is going on? Why is he picking this job? And come to find out, oh, there's this jump opportunity that I could go into.
But you knew.
I knew.
It was the in-between.
It was the in-between.
It was the foot in the door that still satisfied your parents' wishes.
Yep. So then I was joining the service. They didn't know why the heck I was doing what I was doing. And then they saw, well, maybe he'll go for this thing. And so that was really how it started. I remember being at basic training, and I knew because of the Ask Jeeves type site, the about.com that existed, I actually knew the first set of bases that I was eligible to go to after tech school. And so I wrote them down in a list of like 1 to 5 and got my number one, and it kind of lined up from there. So really kind of, you know, like I said, super outgoing, looking for a sense of adventure, wanted something more. Thought I was going to go around my parents when I joined the Air Force, and that was the initial salvo into, you know, what would be the last 20 years. Huh. So Germany was my first assignment.
Yep.
After, you know, joining, and my mom and dad were able to make my basic training graduation, so that was pretty neat.
Yeah, you were an honor grad at basic training.
So, honor grad,
so
yeah.
How much, as a guy, you say you were kind of in the bottom tier of academics? And then, you know, hey, the military, you kind of excelled early on. Did that, was it a thing where, hey, if I apply myself, I mean, obviously you were motivated.
Yeah.
That was a factor.
I would say that, you know, it was something where, because I had set rules and requirements and standards, it was clearly written out, here's the time and space that you have to do the task, and we're going to check your homework and make sure that you're good to go. And for some reason I thought, oh, I've got a set standard I need to meet. There's other people depending on me.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, those drivers really led me to performance.
I was going to say, because I bring it up, because I was the same thing for me. Like, I literally didn't know if I was going to walk my high school graduation until, you know, the day before, because I had to go to night school. I had given up on myself. I was not doing well in school. But the same thing you talked about, the structure, the accountability to somebody else. I've got teammates. For me, early on as a young adult, like it was very formative.
Yeah, so it was a, you know, an interesting way to take early leadership roles and responsibility. And that's kind of a theme, you know, as I think back on the aspects of my career to this point of, in the absence of the opportunity by your job to have a leadership role, you kind of seek things out. So maybe that was part of what led into, you know, being recognized for honor grad and always raising my hand when they needed somebody, yeah. You know, hey, we need someone to pull dorm guard duty late at night, and I gave up more sleep, or you know, hey, we need someone to volunteer for this thing. And I would always be the one to raise my hand, because it was just something of, I'm not going to let the position go unfilled.
Right.
Realizing that, you know, I'm not going to have all the energy in the world, but I was pretty motivated to say, hey, I'm going to be a part of this. If I'm really going to go all in, I'm going to go all in. So.
Yeah. So thinking about that, you know, so this is 2004, you're through training by 2005. Is that right? Go to Germany. So that this next kind of chapter for your career, you know, Was it what you thought it would be? And then those other people who you're looking up to, like, you know, who were they, or what were the kind of things that kind of continued to push you a little bit?
Yeah, so at the time when I got to the first assignment, I'd been in almost a year. It was a really long tech school, about 8 months. And then I get to Germany and I find myself behind a computer thinking, this is not what was advertised. You know, all the photos were men and women out in the woods, out working with fighter aircraft, out seeing the airfield, you know, and I was at a location that the airfield had just been turned over to the German government, actually, so there were no aircraft left, and it had shut down an emergency airfield, so the aircraft were at Ramstein, and I'm with a bunch of airmen at a not a training unit, but an upgrade unit, where everyone gets their 5-level and then moves on to an operational job. And so it was really kind of finding the value in what is it that I'm going to do here. Because I liked the weather part, that was pretty interesting. It taught me how to value everyone else's job at the same time, because everybody was impacted by it.
Now, it was special operations weather at the time?
No.
It wasn't, okay.
So it was not. So I'm in the conventional meteorology side supporting USAFE. We had everything from Keflavik, Iceland, down into the Mediterranean, as far west as Lajes, as far east as some of the borders into CENTCOM at that point. And so this was all remote work. You're talking with the men and women that are at the OSSs, at the given units, but you didn't go and see. And I had a couple opportunities to go out for some basic field-style training with the 786, the Ravens that were there. You know, I was a young A1C at the time, and we played Op 4 with them. I went on a TDY to go and assist with one of the trans-Oceanic abort landing sites for the shuttle. Got to go and do that as an A1C senior airman at that time. That kind of opened my eyes to being a part of something bigger than yourself. And I knew that, you know, there was a time frame of when to apply within the first assignment. You had to be a senior airman. You had to be able to head to both airborne and SEER training at that time. And then you still had to get picked up by the unit. There was one squadron at the time, the 10th Combat Weather Squadron, that owned all of the combat weather capabilities for, at the time, AFSOC proper, and that's what I was applying towards. And so I went through that process over a period of about a year and a half as I was closing up my time in Germany, and then went to an initial tactical training exercise that they hosted, and they said, okay, you're hired as a young senior airman, before I went to then what was upgrade training at Hurlburt Field. It was about an eight-month process to go from being considered then a weather 5-level to a SAU-T, then 7-level. It gave all the tactical training that I just had not had. But I think up until that point, though, there was always a hunger for being a part of the mission.
Yeah.
You know, because there I was geographically separated from everything I was supporting. How could I help these aircraft if I didn't see them? How could I help these people if I didn't see them? And so thinking, well, I got to get to this war before it's over. Yeah. Thinking that at the time, that Operations Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, Trans-Sahara, all the different areas around the world, I wanted to go and make an impact so that I could use my skills, and at the same time, so that somebody else didn't have to go, was the thought, right? The calling.
So going from Germany, you get accepted in the community, you got out of Hurlburt Field, and you meet a girl somewhere in this story.
Yeah. So I meet my wife, Allison, you know, we've been together now 12 years, but at the time, I was in training for probably about 3 months at the time. She was working at the base pool as a lifeguard, and I thought I was like Mr. Macho, you know, running around in the best shape of my life, driving a sports car, thinking I'm Mr.
That hasn't
like
changed.
Joe Cool. No, definitely not. Not as cool as I thought I was. Less muscle now than then, definitely. But having the opportunity to just get to know her, and that was while in training. So at the time, I'm going through what was advanced skills training with a series of fellow future SAU-T operators and combat controllers and fellow pararescue men. And we're all just waiting to go to war because we knew at the end then we would fall into deployment cycles. And so Alice and I were dating at that time. She was in her junior of college, and she went back to school, you know, and I went to war.
You went forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is 2008 timeframe now?
Yeah, 2008. So it's the fall of 2008. And then I had the opportunity to go forward with the 23rd Special Tactics Squadron. And then at the time, the Special Operations Weather Team, or SAU-T mission, was really on environmental reconnaissance. So the portion of how do you give battlefield commanders time and space to make a decision, whether that's the air tasking order and what they're going to bring out for close air support, to trafficability, to the Defense Intelligence Agency had a lot of roles where they were taking the terrain assessment data that we were doing, and basically what you're doing is allowing aviation assets or ground-based assets the advantage above the enemy based on the environmental conditions. So all of the training that I had done before, whether that was some small drone operations or basics in avalanche forecasting and assessment, I got to use in Afghanistan immediately as soon as I got there, supporting a Marine Special Operations team. And so this is, like I said, the fall of 2008. We're getting heavy into the winter portion there. I was in the far western portion of Afghanistan, very, for our provinces, I would say very cowboy country type. You have to go a long way to see people. Not a lot of air assets out there. If you were to look at the bases we had at the time, the western side of the country between Herat and the far northwest, Dalaram in the central, and I was south there at Farah, and was with this team supporting their continuous operations. They were looking at what was coming out of the western theater at the time. You had, Iranian proxy influence over the border because we were only about 100 miles away from the border. And then at the same time, you had a lot of attacks on different infantry units. So whether that was IEDs, caches, staffing, wartime materials. So I was able to go out with that Marine Special Operations team from 2nd Special Operations, Marine Special Operations Battalion, or 2nd MSOB, and do about a good 3 months worth of work, solid with them.
Yeah, I know when I was asking you to sit down and have this conversation, we're like, hey, it's all on the table. And so I think, in this point now, and we were, even before we turned the mics on, we talked about how tomorrow is kind of an anniversary of this. So if you could tell us on, January 23rd, 2009, kind of how that really affected, your life and the lives of people who know you.
Yeah. So, that'll be 15 years then tomorrow. But it was about 3 months into that deployment at the time, and the team was doing a land movement back with vehicles from one objective to go back to our main fort, our operating base. And at the time, there was extensive rain that had filled all the wadi areas, and so we had to cancel going after one target and ended up having to use the roadways to get home, which often you would try and stay, as off the roads as much as possible just due to the risk of counterattacks or IEDs, what have you. And we were driving back that night. I was in the fourth vehicle of four in a convoy with myself, and it was in a gun truck. So these are Humvees that are up armored. And then that way you can dismount if necessary if you're going to take an objective or a target. And so we were basically geared for direct action missions at that time. And little did I know that on the way back, we were probably, I'd say, two-thirds of the way home back to the FOB that night, and the three trucks in front of me ran over what was a pressure plate IED that was two layers of particle board with nuts or walnuts in between to keep the metal plates from conducting. And then once those hit, IED went off immediately under my truck. I was the driver at the time, so I should preface that. So I'm in the driver's seat. There's no one sitting in the truck commander seat or the right-hand seat. There's two members in the back, one in the turret, and then we have two in the rear of the vehicle manning the crew serve weapons. And a series of old anti-tank mines and mortars are put together, and the charge is conical. So it comes up like a cone, and it shears off the whole front edge of this truck. As soon as it went off, I remember the explosion and then waking up afterwards, but it takes off the whole front quarter of the truck, which we had found and had rotated about 180 degrees and then rolled three times. And then the floorboards of the truck had come in and crushed my feet and ankles in. And so while the truck is rolling, my teammates were either thrown out of it, one ended up being pinned under the turret of the truck at the time, and then I was stuck inside the vehicle. So fortunately, by being in that position, I think it saved me from further injury from then being thrown, because there were other, photos that we saw later of the doors, that had been removed and in the inner portions of the truck being mangled. But the truck did its job, helping to get the blast away. But because of those injuries, you know, I was then kept in the truck. And then later found myself waking up, coming to on the road by some of the teammates from the truck ahead. So by the time the explosion had gone off, the three trucks ahead of us had come back to pull up and pull a security cord on. And my NODs are gone. So my NVGs, night vision goggles, are gone. Some of my kit is messed up and torn. I can tell that my chin is bleeding at the time. So it was once my helmet had shifted, it had cut different areas under my chin, had some pain in my jaw for a second. Later, I would find out I had some cracked teeth from that. Could still hear. So my Peltors, the headphones that we wear, you know, had done their job. The doc would joke with me later that because I was chewing gum, that probably helped with the pressurization, equalizing the pressure on the back end.
This is at night?
Yes, this is night. So,
and you're a senior airman staff sergeant at the time?
Yeah, senior airman, staff select. Select. So, just a senior airman, right? And as the rest of the team, the security cordon is pulling out, I remember them asking me, "Hey, Alex, can you walk? Can you get up?" And I could feel my adrenaline running, and I'm like, "Yeah, I think I'm good." And as they go to pull me up, the graininess or the grinding feeling of my ankles, my feet being like just decimated in my boots, could kind of hear and visually feel that, and I just couldn't be moved. And so I then became the area of the casualty collection point, and with my M9 and my magazines as they start to pull out, so that way I could at least hold security until we're waiting. And then it was at that point where I could feel like the early symptoms of like shock start to set in for myself as they were corralling the rest of my teammates and getting us packaged up. And the good news is, out of the entirety of the truck that evening, of the five guys that were with us, all survived, all with different severity levels of injuries, some which were career ending, but all were life altering at that point. And within, you know, just the amount of time we got hit, we were fortunate to have Provincial Reconstruction Team Hospital adjacent to our FOB, and since we were already, you know, three quarters of the way there, they
on
were
the way
able
back.
To get. Yeah. Yep, they got their 60s out, picked us up. We had a Special Operations Surgical Team, a SOST, that was actually assigned with us, and then they came out and got us, which was great. And so, as far as circumstances were concerned, no secondary fires or explosions, no ambush situation. It was the perfect situation of which to have the worst thing happen, and at the same time, have a high level of survivability, you know, where your kit did its job, where the team did their job perfectly, and, got us all back into initial surgeries. And then within a period of, you know, less than 24 to 48 hours, we were from then Farah province back to Bagram, and then on a C-17 to Ramstein to Launchtool.
Yep.
And then the following days, the 2 to 5 days after that, everybody was then either back stateside or in further surgery waiting to be transported. So
did you go from how long did you get Launchtool to the Walter Reed?
It was just a matter of a few days.
Okay.
Because then once I went to Walter Reed, I was then further transported onto Eglin Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Which at the time you still had, you know, Walter Reed was the old Walter Reed Hospital. This is after it had gone through a lot of the internal IG review issues at the time. And so the decision by my command team was made, hey, if we can get Alex down to Eglin at the time, to go there, and if I needed to go for follow-up or further surgery somewhere else with a specialist, they would do that. And so really the initial recovery was, hey, let's bring them home.
Yeah.
And so I came back to Eglin. So within a period of just, you know, 5 days of getting hurt, I'm back home. It's pretty rapid if you think about it compared to World War II, Korea, Vietnam, when you would have months to weeks. Now you're in days. I remember the rapid transition of my buddies at Bagram and, you know, shedding tears and being on the phone with guys at Launchtool, obviously pretty, you know, doped up at that time on meds and just trying to make as many connections as I could. And I still had actually teammates that had been in my old unit in Germany, and they came out and saw me at the hospital. And so I remember just like hugging them and crying and just trying to process, you know, what was going on by the time I got home.
When was the first time you talked to mom and dad or Allison at that point?
So I had talked to my mom and dad actually in the emergency room at Bagram at Craig Hospital. I remember my team captain had come in and called them on the phone. And I just remember crying, you know, at the time, and almost like I'd let him down, you know, like, hey, I'm coming home, you know, this happened. And then my bosses were really good with like, hey, we got everything. We'll take care of Alex. You know, don't worry about it. We'll orchestrate like when y'all get together. But then they made the calls, I remember, to what would eventually be my mother and father-in-law and to my girlfriend at the time.
Yeah.
So she could receive that information. And I can only imagine how hard that was to receive, you know, someone you've only been dating a few months at the same time. I remember we first said, I love you. And, you know,
right.
And the next thing you know, it's a life-changing series of circumstances that no one signs up for, you know.
Right. Yeah. So. You know, and so I think, you know, as you said, tomorrow, that was 15 years ago.
Yeah, 15 years.
You know, today you sit here as the Senior NCO Academy Commandant. You know, you've been selected. You're about to go be a command chief. Or maybe we'll talk about that, you know, in a little bit. But how much in that moment, you know, both a, you know, I think anybody, you maybe think you'll know what'll happen, something like that. You try to rehearse it in your mind. How much did that, were you really tested on the values you were kind of brought up in? And then what were your thoughts kind of on what you were fighting for after that? I mean, beyond just obviously the physical recovery.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of emotion, you know, because, you know, I'll ask the person, hey, we talked a little bit why you joined, but I mean, you're sitting here, obviously still serving with a purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and so how much can you share about kind of that piece and defining that moment and how it's built you to be a leader you are today?
Yeah, so I ended up later going through a recovery period twice. So the first time, you know, when this is 2009, it was about 7 months that I was wheelchair bound before I went to walk again. So I'll kind of walk through that one first. You know, at the time, because I hadn't gone to Walter Reed proper or to Brooks down in Texas, the decision was made, hey, you know, you're just going to be wheelchair bound. You could either stay here, and all the teams were deployed forward. You know, everyone with the 23rd Special Tactics Squadron on that rotation was still out. Hey, Alex, you basically just have to put no weight on your feet after the series of surgeries you've had, and we'll see what happens. So they went to pursue hyperbaric treatment, which was very early at that time, to try and restore blood flow and growth to different areas of my ankles. I ended up going on extended con leave, if you will, for about 6 months at that time, and actually went back to Colorado, moved back in with my parents at the time. They're at least kind enough to do that, along with the community support aspect. And then as I went through, you know, rehab, I actually went up to the Air Force Academy. Hmm. And the connection of my original ortho at Eglin, he knew a fellow ortho surgeon at the academy who I ended up doing all my follow-ups with. So I would go to the cadet clinic, roll in with my wheelchair, you know, get up on my knees and crank out pull-ups on the pull-up bar as the young cadets are coming in with sports injuries. It was one of those moments where I think it really turned my eye to the value of what I was gonna give back, you know, to others, because it was a really bad situation. I have no idea what the future is gonna bring, because I'm about to pin staff sergeant in a few months. I can't do my job anymore. At least I don't know what it's going to look like to go back and do this job that I've just recently qualified for. And so what would a return to operations look like? No idea. And I think that was kind of like one of those early pivotal moments, realizing that I could do something different.
Yeah. And so you have all these questions, right? And these unknowns. What do you tell yourself? But here's what I'm going to,
yeah,
get after.
I'm just going to drive on. I'm going to do whatever I can to get back in, and first it was to walk. I'm gonna walk as normal as possible. Maybe I can return to run. We'll see what that looks like.
So you were
like
just picking off incremental targets?
Yep, you know, 5 meter targets consistently. Kept doing email updates, I remember, with my commander at the time and first sergeant, just trying to keep the unit up to date. I remember going back to watch that first rotation of guys come back from that deployment, and just the hugs and the tears and the love and care and camaraderie. And then I think all of those things just started to kind of plug in the value proposition of like, what does this mean, you know, for me? And I remember the chief at the time, you know, he said to me, hey, Alex, come back when you're ready. Mm. Which, if you think about it, you know, we had already been in conflict, you know, as an Air Force at that point for 8 years. The Air Force Wounded Warrior Program was really nascent, mm-hmm, in its capabilities. I was taken care of heavily by the Special Operations Command Care Coalition at the time,
yeah,
now known as the Soft Warrior Care Program. Congressionally mandated on both sides, actually, for the Air Force and for the Combat Command. And so they kind of held me behind the scenes, and then I had a unit really supportive. And so when it was, hey, Alex, return to work, well, what am I going to do when I get back? we'll find something for you.
Yeah.
And I just said, hey, I'm willing to be plugged
in
whatever.
You still have value. That was, yeah, that was still, affirmed, right?
Still, like, I can do something. And they noticed all the drive. And so I remember walking back into the unit on, like, long wrist crutches and slowly getting back integrated with the unit. And then that was at the time where my superintendent said to me, hey, Alex, you're going to go ahead and plug into the A4 shop. You're going to work everything from radios and all of our firearms account to, you know, training scheduling and logistics and nothing that I was trained for at that point. You're just going to have to figure it out. But at least the point for me was I'm going to take care of my buddies that are going out the door.
Right. Yeah. So how long did it take you to walk independently again?
Yeah. So that was about, you know, 7 months, I would say fully 8 months by the time. So the end of 2009 is when I'm able to finally ambulate without using crutches or anything else.
Yeah, I did look at it, you know, from the time of the incident. You know, you went to ALS in 2010.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was waivered, you know, obviously for attendance.
I think you had a pretty good reason for a deferment.
Yeah, I was cleared for deferment, right? And then, you know, ended up getting back into work. And then in that time, you know, obviously going to ALS, being a little more of rank, because I'd pinned on staff then, and that's normally where you become, you know, like a flight lead or something like that in an early position. And so it was something where I had gone from a job where I had supervised myself to a position where now I'm supervising my own recovery to now I'm back in a job where I'm one deep.
Yeah.
And that theme starts to play out, you know, in the remainder of my career of what do you do when you're one deep in the military, and how do you then think about units for span of control? Like, how do you think about leading others and developing others and growing when my career field now is very small? And we'll kind of get into some more of that later. But that kind of gets into the value point of I'm going to take every opportunity I can to grow and learn as I'm getting back on duty until something opens up. I'm just going to work and work and work until there's an opportunity that I can capitalize on or be asked to do something.
And so your role in the, you talked a little bit about the CARE Coalition, you know, really at the Joint and DoD side, is that happening? You're starting to, so they did something for you and your role giving back and then taking kind of a more of a active role in that community. Was that shortly after, or is there another piece in between?
Yeah, so throughout 2010, I remember, you know, working heavily behind the scenes because it wasn't until then in 11, you know, that I ended up PCSing up to Walter Reed Hospital. I remember getting called up to the AFSOC Command Chief's office and they said, you know, hey, Alex, we've got a job for you. We want you to do.
And who was that at the time?
That was Michael Gilbert, who was the AFSOC Command Chief at the time. And he just said, hey, we just need you to get ready to take care of others.
Yeah.
And you know, it was one of those questions where
clear intent.
You're a staff sergeant, so what's the thing you ask? Like, hey, what's the training plan? What do you need me to do? You have to use what you know and what you've been through and seek every opportunity out to take care of others. And so little did I know I would be called into a job that at the time there was a, it would later be called the Recovery Care Coordinator Program, which is now DoD-wide, but there was no formal course at the time. And so it was a very ad hoc pickup game style of, hey, you're going to go and spend time. You know, once you get to this assignment, you're going to go spend time in and around the VA, and you're going to spend time around the Guard and the Reserve. And oh, by the way, you know, you're a lone airman in an office that at the time we had three guys from 20th Special Forces Group, because the U.S. Army or USASOC, Army Special Operations Command, is the majority of the population inside U.S. SOCOM. And so it just so happened that the detachment, if you will, that I was at, where I was TAC on, supervised tactical control, was with a bunch of seasoned Green Berets that were all in their mid to late 50s. And so here I come in, this young guy, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, in my early 20s, and they really sat me down and went through operations like, here's a legal pad and here's a pencil. You know, we're still gonna use some stuff on a fax machine, by the way. And it made things very deliberate of how I would think about things. And little did I know, you know, a few years later, all the time that they would spend growing and mentoring me would be key into how I would view team leadership, organizational leadership, for all the things that we face. So
you were in school.
That's right.
I didn't know it. You were definitely, yeah. I mean, that is really fascinating, especially, you know, that's going on. And then I have to imagine there's a piece where you know, for what was going on in the nation, you know, at the time. I mean, there were a lot of people who were getting injured downrange.
Yeah.
You know, coming home to Walter Reed, and I mean, that was you, right? Yeah. So now you're there.
So at that time, you know, the job, as it still is today, the care management and transition of wounded, ill, and injured service members. So whether that was downrange, a gunshot wound, an IED, helicopter crash, appendicitis, broken shoulder, because life happens in a deployed environment, right? Just the same stateside, men and women with stage 3, stage 4 cancer, car accident, training issue. And so we would get these families in the midst of crises in their lives. And I would do everything from pick them up from the airport when they first came in to see their loved one, to take them to bedside, and then basically hold their hand from day one for however long it took. You know, none of the members, fortunately, by the time I had arrived in 11, were still there years later, but we had some patients that were with us for multiple years. And that's everything from, you know, some burn victims, the majority of them went to Texas, but gunshot wounds, single, double, triple, quadruple amputees, high-level brain injuries, men and women that had sacrificed the utmost, you know, for their nation, and then how to help their husbands and wives and their kids get through these moments. So when I would explain the job to people, they'd say, well, what do you do? I said, you know, I'm a liaison for wounded, ill, and injured. And for active duty folks, I would say it's a combination of like being a first sergeant, a chaplain, a family friend, and a social worker, kind of all rolled into one, where it was one day could be helping them get benefits. And then the next day, you know, as they're looking towards retirement, let's say, or maybe an active duty member is going to continue in service and needs to get a medical TDY somewhere to, you know, I get to watch a young child run up to their mother or father that has robotic legs or prostheses for the first time, and the parent is walking for the first time. And so both are learning to walk at the same time. I mean,
You're tech sergeant duty at the time.
Yes, yeah, staff almost tech sergeant at that point. So talk about some heavy stuff, you know, for a junior member. And so all that aside, I'm getting this foundational time of caring for our brothers and sisters in uniform. It's super valued. I think personally, I didn't realize how much it was changing me. Got the opportunity to redeploy. So almost 3 years to the day of getting hurt, I went back to Afghanistan, was at Bagram Hospital there, at Craig Hospital, and got to walk into the ER and go, oh, that's where the bed was, you know, that I was put in, and actually spent 7 months deployed. We were getting one member, like you said, per week out of the Special Operations Formation, either a combat injury or combat-related injuries, one a week, because we're doing a high tempo of operations at that time. And so being able to be on the receiving end and make the system better, I remember doing that and then helping the Afghan National Army as an example. So all of a sudden I find myself going from looking at my internal perspective just a few years earlier of I got to get better to now I'm fixing or helping, if you will, everybody from all other services to, oh my gosh, now I'm helping people from other nations. And then by the time I got back from that deployment, I had an email that said, hey, Alex, there's going to be a position coming open on a Secretary of Defense Advisory Task Force. I'm a brand new tech sergeant going, I have no idea what this is, and made a couple calls. And then I come back from the deployment and then spent the next 2 years really traveling around the country, going to active guard reserve bases, some VAs, and really helping make sure that we gave a good product on the other side of the DD-214, you know, that when members had something happen in service and then they retired or they retained in service, could they cross-train, let's say, into another AFSC rate MOS? What would it look like for them to return to service or return to combat operations if possible? And it really kind of, I would say, capped out what that job was, because I came into a job that had no duty description, just a charge of go and help others. And, you know, it's the majority of my time as a technical sergeant is spent there, all of it, actually. So I redeploy, and then I find out that I make master right as I'm leaving. And so my career rapidly accelerates from the one operational deployment and then the second
back,
deployment.
You make it as a, on the Wounded Warrior side, you make it on back in your operational community?
So yeah. I made tech in the operational community, still on the PDGSKT side, yep. And then I made the stripe as master under the Wounded Warrior program, because at the time, at the tail end of my DC time, my ankle started giving out again. And so it's that decision of, okay, I'm being med boarded. I'd kind of hit out from the board, if you will, since 09, had some very great doctors that took care of me. And then really, you know, I don't fault the Air Force for it, but I'm a readiness issue at that point. If I'm seeing constant care and having just severe arthritis from the original repairs that were done to my ankles, then the next phase is going to be, okay, what can I do? You know, and I don't want to gloss over this too fast, but it was a big struggle because I was looking at elective amputation at the time of both of my feet. There weren't a lot of cases of men and women retained in service that had crush injuries. Deck foot, as it would be called heavily in World War II, of anything that had come up from above and all that absorbing of a shock and you've just shattered bone, the functionality just isn't there for the rest of the body. So my wife and I looked at elective amputation, pursued that for several months, and then had a physician that said, hey, put the brakes on. You know, you've got a good foundation. You would be a good candidate for bilateral ankle fusion. And I went and Googled up ankle fusion, and the only people that do it are your grandparents. You know, it's something where you now are going to fuse the joint and restrict the movement. And normally, it's grandma and grandpa walking from the kitchen to the bedroom to the couch, maybe to the grocery store. And so I couldn't find cases where men and women had been retained in service with a single joint fusion, let alone two. And I thought, well, I'm up for a challenge. Let's see what'll happen. And so at the time that I go in for the fusions, I'm going through the med board. And then by the time that the fusions are done and I spend about 4 to 5 months again in a wheelchair, so it's the second time in my career I'm in a wheelchair, I get back up, I go and start power walking afterwards. I ended up doing a series of 5Ks, getting my power walking times fast enough to pass the run time. And then I went and met the med board. And it was kind of one of those moments of, go ahead, tell me that I'm not worth it to serve because I'm trying to just meet the retention standard at this point, or I am meeting the retention standard, you know, with a very limited waiver process at that point, and got a call that I was retained in service. So I find I'm retained, and then got the call that I made master. And so it was kind of like a renewed lease on, now I'm going to have to take all of this because my career field is then saying, hey, you know, we're tiny. At that time, the SAO-T career field was just under 100 total members, and so that's very small for any AFSC. And I got a call that said, hey, Alex, we got a job for you, and we need you to come back and be a superintendent of programs. And so it's that area of fear of, wow, I'm now 5 to 6 years removed from what my brothers in arms are doing. At the time, they were all out rotating with the special tactics squadrons through the 4-gen cycle. So they've got 2, 3, 4, 5 deployments. And here I come back to oversee career field level programs. You have to think of it like a base functional manager type, type role of organize, train, equip functions. And so it was a time of drastic change to go back into that, but I was really eager to get to work and just kind of give back in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think there's no way when you came in that we would ever build a career path like this, right? You know, but through it, I mean, obviously you're a result of your experiences, right? And those who have poured into you and you continue to pour into others. You know, one thing I hear people ask sometimes, like, what's your leadership philosophy, right? You know, through all that, I mean, you definitely got put into very unconditional roles. Like it wasn't, this isn't normally how we would do this. Were you kind of building in your own mind, like, hey, you know, these are the kind of things that I think really stick out for me, whether it's personal leadership, whether it's professional leadership? You know, do you ever kind of pause and because you had to go into a room, like to your point, like you were never the ranking guy.
Yeah.
You were never the, but you were given a pretty big task.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know if you had any thoughts on that.
No, I would think of the aspect of what I caught for leadership lessons. You know, as I mentioned, I didn't have the span of control because I was the most junior guy in the office. But at one time, I remember we had 20 to 30 patients all from, you know, E2 up through 08, 09. Right. And so I'm dealing with all ranks, all services. It's their awards. It's their decks. It's their fit reps or EPRs or OPRs. It's Article 15 related issues. I'm doing all of these things behind the scenes. So I see the unit management style role that a superintendent would normally have or even that a commander would have because they were all adconned in this situation. But then every single day I got exposed to watching great leaders execute in the most dire circumstances. You know, I remember we would do the DV visits often, you know, with members, because depending on the community, you would often have a lot of the 2, 3, and 4 stars in the DC area would come and visit troops of their given service or make rounds. And at the time when, I remember specifically when General Dunford was the Commandant of the Marine Corps, I remember taking him around to see a couple of our MARSOC Marines, our Raiders that were there, and just some additional patients, because he then said, hey, I want to see who else you have here from the SOF formation. And I remember someone having a kid, you know, in their room, probably a toddler, 2, 3 years old. And I remember General Dunford being his Class Bs. And so just getting on the floor, and I know his shoes got scuffed, and he's now on his knees, like playing with the member's kid in the room and just being a human being. Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of moments where I realize that no matter what your rank or position, like, this is what it's really about. It's the time and investment that you're going to give in other people. Because what I saw was consistency, and it was just again and again and again. And I think that was probably one of the early lessons where, no matter if you're the guy or gal that shows up early and, you know, it's a presentation and you're the one to set up the chairs and take them down or pick up the trash, like, every job's important, but at the same time, are you going to do it again and again and again? It's watching someone like a General Dunford, or pick, you know, any of our senior leaders in that position, where they see some of the most dire circumstances and show a love and care and concern for family members and for this profession of what we are. I think it showed me how to lead through crises in a different way. And I got to watch leaders fail, you know, got to watch members fail in the most dire circumstances. So if I knew both ends of the spectrum, I could kind of find out what works in the middle. And then I would say, you know, I was always put in places that would then challenge me as soon as I left, that I had a big team of people to lean on if I had a question about, hey, I'm now going through this for the first time. But it didn't feel like the first time, because when I went to my next job, as an example, I had a team of contractors and a multi-million-dollar contract and no military subordinate. So I go from a bunch of military subordinates that I have TAC on, or tactical control, to a situation where I had a series of contractors and a contract. And everyone would say, well, then how do you do that without a span of control? And it's like, you get to know people. People are people. And so not a day goes by I don't reflect on, obviously, the circumstances that brought me to that point, but the leadership lessons learned, you know, from those seasoned individuals ahead of me that took time to invest in a young 20-something who just wanted to continue to do mission, and realizing, like, hey, it's okay to not do mission all the time. There's other, you know, time and space to plug in with family.
So. Yeah, I love that. I think you know, some people, they try to put, you know, leadership on the pedestal of their positions, but, you know, everything you just outlined, it's so personal. You know, whether it is getting down on the knees and playing with the kids, whether it is, you know, just developing the relationship side. I mean, inherently, I mean, that's what it is. It's the gift to have influence in someone else's life, you know, and I think that's great. I have to ask you, though, too. So you also, in your bio, you have the Naval Postgraduate School you went to.
Yeah.
We talked a lot early on, like, hey, I wasn't really about school. And so now, where's that thirst for, one, I don't know how you even went to that school. Two, where does your thirst for learning kind of, where does that get activated?
Yeah, so, you know, I have to go back to, the only reason I ended up getting my, let's say, my CCAF degree and then using the Air University Associate Baccalaureate Cooperative, because it was new at the time, was because when I got back from the deployment in 12, I had an Army Master Sergeant sit me down with an Air Force Master Sergeant that was retiring. So I had two guys that were seasoned. It was basically, they both grabbed me by the collar and they said, you owe us a plan to finish your CCAF now that you're back from this deployment, Tech Sergeant, figure it out. And then you're going to show us a plan to get your bachelor's, and it's going to be done by the time you leave this assignment. Because they both realized, you know, that I needed to create options for myself. You know, they knew my physical condition and everything, but it was because they kind of pulled me aside that I really planned it out. So if you go from the time I get back from the deployment, I ended up finishing the bachelor's and being on the road a lot in that 2 years. And I checked that block, you know, because a degree without the ability to follow through is just a piece of paper that sits on the wall. I learned some stuff and thought, okay, now I got this bachelor's in human resources. I've arrived. I'm in the people business. I know what I'm doing. At the time when you had your CCAF and some additional credits and course 14 completed, it opened the door for other jobs and for vectoring, kind of what we're getting now to as a service, more job opportunities. Well, you fast forward through this job. I mentioned that I was leading these contractors as a superintendent for the Saudi career field. And a call came out throughout the MAGCOM and AFSOC where they wanted to send the first member to Naval Postgraduate School. So there was a program that's been out there for some years, over 30 plus years, in Special Operations Irregular Warfare. It was actually Special Operations Low Intensity Conflict. And when the call out came, myself and I know another few members were put in, and at the time it was Command Chief Greg Smith was the AFSOC Command Chief, and I remember meeting with him when I found out that my package had been selected, and the premise was, hey, Alex, you've done good things in the last 18 months of this job. The intent is for you to go and to think differently when you come back. You're going to spend time, you know, amongst men and women that are majors, lieutenant colonels of both the Air Force and of sister services equivalent, and you're going to learn a lot about how to do special operations from a operational strategic perspective so that it's not the next assignment, it's the multiple assignments following where we can get the return on investment out of you. So I remember saying, like, hey, you know, Chief Smith, what's the charge? And he goes, make it worth it. Just make it worth it. You know what to do. Treat it like you treated everything else. And so I went out and really went after how to get the marrow out of the experience. I remember reporting in because at the time, you know, enlisted to AFIT had been around several years. The enlisted program at Naval Postgrad is now far more mature, but at the time only OSI agents were attending a fraud program that existed there, a master's for financial accounting that they were doing. And then other fields over the years have started to grow out. But at that time, it was myself and two other airmen that were there, enlisted airmen. One was a tech sergeant, the other that came was later a master sergeant. And I spent that 18 months really looking deep at the soft enterprise and everything from strategy to aspects of contributions in irregular warfare and history to, you know, what are the elements in national power that I can really say, how do we get the competitive advantage, you know, on different things? And I really did what Greg Smith charged me to do, was take every opportunity you can, take every unique elective that you can, so that you're best prepared, because I didn't know where I was going to go after that. There was no targeted placement yet after that assignment, because it was 18 months. And so I arrived there as a master. I found out I'm making senior. And at the end, they had come up with, hey, there's an assignment available. We're going to send you down to the Joint Special Operations University, and that will be the ROI. That'll be the payback tour. Right. You know, back into education.
And return on investment for everybody listening in. Yeah,
that's exactly right. So I took a couple classes, I remember, at NPS where I got scared. I say got scared as in, if you challenge yourself enough in something where you go, I don't know if I'm going to pass this class. I had a couple in mathematics. I remember I took a game theory class, and I barely got by on the skin of my teeth and for the hours of studying. And I took an operations management class, and I took several others that really pushed my level of thinking. And if it weren't for that, then you know where your limitations are. So I do these kinds of things, and I remember just leaving thinking, I've left it all on the table. I've got as much out of this experience, and I've set something up for the men and women to follow, to kind of fall in on programs. So beside that, before I get to the point about working at the Joint Special Operations University, because I didn't know where I was going to go, the element commander at the time, Lieutenant Colonel, I chose to use that relationship as the commander SEL tour, if you will. I thought, okay, I'm his, you know, his SEL at the time, Presidio, which is right down the road. You know, they have a series of colonels and
not,
chiefs.
Not a bad
there.
Place.
Not a bad place. Yeah, one of the best kept secrets in the Department of Defense in Monterey. But I used that time with that lieutenant colonel over that 18 months to get his mentorship of me and help him advise him in decision making and kind of be what an SEL would be in a line unit, kind of emulate some of that stuff, because he didn't have an SEL, he didn't have a diamond, he didn't have a front office exec. And so whenever I was outside of class, I spent as much time with him trying to get his sight picture on things.
Yeah, and I don't know, for those listening in, you know, there's something pretty powerful about what you're saying. In a way, you kind of created your own elective. You kind of created your own SEL elective. You know, a lot of times I think people try to, hey, you know, the Air Force, they need to give me this, or they, you know, like this course. But you had an opportunity to reflect and say, hey, what do I need to know? What's likely a future scenarios for me? and then really take that opportunity and kind of get ahead of the game a little bit, right?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I remember I took a class on defense financial management and budgeting. Who does that?
Yeah.
Like I, at the time.
Alex Udy does that. I can tell you that.
Apparently
yeah. All day.
I thought I would.
And anybody who knows you is smiling right now.
And it was not a fun class. I will just say that. But now realizing what it allowed me to do when years later I would walk into situations having to understand how the DoD enterprise works. Okay. Well, I'm glad I spent 3 months of my life reading, you know, that material. So anyway, I'm glad I was challenged to then use the opportunities to develop myself, because I'm not going to wait for, you know, the military to provide me with a position that comes with a duty title that then prescribes what you're going to do, realizing that I'm going to be placed in some type of a position no matter what. And so I might as well prepare myself, because otherwise I'm just going to let the people down of which I'm going to be tasked to serve. Yeah,
and the whole point is you have to take initiative in your own learning.
Yep.
You know, and there's stuff out there that necessarily won't be put on your doorstep, but if you knock on a couple doors, you'll have access to it, you know, but you still got to prioritize it. I mean, this stuff, to your point, a lot of this stuff isn't sexy. It's not the feel good stuff, but I think even there's probably some elements here where you saw the impact at a strategic level of these kind of things, money,
yep,
budgeting, you know what I mean? Like programmatics.
Yeah. Having,
you just saw the influence.
Having the opportunity to brief, you know, some of the current and former Deputy Assistant Secretaries of Defense while at school on projects that we knew were going to be used back in the operational environment was awesome. Portions of the Women in Service Review as an example, on the early threads of that, portions on counterinsurgency strategy for different spots in the Middle East, for greater deterrence in the DoD. It just made me look at problem sets very differently, and say, hey, I can still be of value to this. It's now just a different way. That was probably a big inflection point further of change of now I kind of know where I'm going to be in this space. And so not knowing where I was going to head and then finally told, hey, you're going to go to the Joint Special Operations University and be an instructor in some of their courseware. That was an exciting time to go, hey, I'm really excited for what this is going to bring.
Yeah. Yeah. So JSOW, I have had a chance to go to JSOW. You know, you're talking about several chiefs, so whether it's Greg Smith, right, who also, you know, went to be the CSEL at SOCOM, whether it's Corey Olson, who was AFSOC Command Chief, you know, they both... They got me in a seat for a summit at JSOW, and that was really my first kind of amazing institution. And so, what were the biggest things? Had you taken a lot of the courses there before?
So I had taken Joint Fundamentals, an enterprise management related courseware from them, which were both distance learning in previous jobs, because I was told to by chiefs that said, you will do this because you need to start thinking about this stuff. And then by the time I got there, I went through JSOFC, the Joint Special Operations Forces Senior Enlisted Academy at the time, still 6 months of distance learning and then 2 months in residence. So very rigorous EPME opportunity, but done you know, alongside allies and partners, and then at the same time with all sister services present. But it's very intimate because you're talking, you know, only so many seminars go a year.
Yep.
And so you really get men and women that are coming fresh off the teams across SOCOM, some fresh out of deployment experiences, and then they're plugged into the seminar together to really start to think on greater problem sets, having a, you know, just an operational experience, but start to gain a little bit of a strategic appreciation of what does it mean to push our profession, you know, forward at the same time as lead larger formations. And so I was there and worked the line. This is right about the time as COVID is coming around, 19 into 20.
Yep.
And the interesting part about this is this also, when we talk about the aspect of military family, my wife and I don't have children, and she had made the decision while we were at Naval Postgrad to start the journey of her prerequisites toward something in the medical field. We were thinking physician assistant was going to be a lineup, and that's what it ended up being. Well, you fast forward to this time while I'm at JSOW, and we look at what is a military families' career paths look like together. And my wife ended up working as an EMT in the local area there in Tampa, worked as a phlebotomist as well, or as a lab tech or an ER tech, and assisted there. And so she's building all these prerequisites. And then obviously COVID hits. I'm the one at home at the FOB, if you will. Yeah. She's the one going into work at the time. Yeah. And then we were waiting at the time for her to apply for physician assistant school. And so throughout the course of my time in instructorship there, we go through the period of COVID. I move from working on the podium and teaching students to then a chief of academics style role, which is owning of a EPME continuum, all the courses, all the content, instructor development, again, more growth and development of people. And then my wife was picked up for physician assistant school at that time up in North Carolina. And so I now come up on the aspect of I'm up for chief, I make chief, and she's already away at school. We had made the decision that wherever she got picked up, we would go geographically separated to support. And then we would end up linking back
up. Come back together, yeah.
Yeah, almost 2.5 years later. Wow. So not to fast forward through what would be the next 2.5 years.
I love it though.
Years.
I mean, I think, you know, even Allison, our wives had a chance to meet at a social that the Barnes Center Commander was hosting. And, you know, I think a lot of times people don't realize, you know, that the service and sacrifice, it's family, it's a family thing.
Yeah.
You know, and particularly whether it's career, whether it's the life, whether it's, and so I think it's really great you highlight kind of Allison's, you know, piece on us. Because I remember at the Assumption of Responsibility, you know, not to fast forward, but at the Senior NCO Academy, she was just, that was coming back, right? When you guys got assigned here.
That was the
reunion tour.
Yep, she was about 3 months out from graduation at that point. And so, you know, you think about the aspect of, and we've talked a lot about me, she's always been in support of what I wanted to do, but there was always a discussion of every decision made for every assignment of, hey, what does this look like? What does it mean for both of us to win in this? And then what's the sacrifice point of, okay, if I'm not harming her career progression potential, then, you know, it's okay for me to, you know, continue on, because there's always options.
Yep. Right?
You can always create options for yourself. And so that was one where we look at winning the long game of what does it mean to both have careers, mine being in the armed forces and then obviously hers now being in healthcare. And so at the time where she's up at school, I make chief and then find out that you're going to go to the, Alex, you're going to go to that headquarters AFSOC A58, which that whole planning, programming, budgeting, execution class that I took plays in well for being SEL for in a staff.
You're the requirements and the money guy, right?
Requirements, money, and strategy. Yeah. So we used to joke that everybody will get mad, but by the time that they're mad, you're already 2-3 guys removed from the job, right? For what you're doing. And so we had about 120 or so folks in there. So it's about the size of a medium to smaller squadron, but all more seasoned individuals in their military careers. And then that was my first role, you know, as a chief. So this unnatural style career path, I would say, you know, continues. If you look at a career field education and training plan, all of these stops in those last few are not there. And, but it was a great job to flow into of, okay, now I've had all this combatant command level experience where I've been able to sit with the J3 of a COCOM and understand how are we conducting operations, both from a functional standpoint and from a global perspective, all the way through the 5 in strategy sessions and the 8 with budgeting. And so I can see the bigger picture of where everything's going. And then I get to go up and work at the MAGCOM and really help the force design change for, hey, we're about to pivot from this counter VEO to what would be then strategic competition. You know, what does that mean between the crisis response actions, the cost sustainable CVEO, and then competition, and then ultimately conflict if necessary, and how do we work that scale and scope? And so really kind of getting my hands and feet heavy into that. So I learned more about people and basing and airframes and the capital that is our Air Force, and how do we message that up onto the Hill, and at the same time, how do we move that down and in internally so when we're changing the mission, men and women know what's about to happen. And so yeah, that was a great, great role. And then if you move on, you know, further from that, let's say I was in the job for just over about a year at that time and got a call that said, hey, Alex, we'd like you to interview for another job.
Who was that call from?
I got that call from Chief Olson, from Corey Olson, who was then at that time was still the AFSOC command chief. He would been be retiring within the next year following. and basically said, hey, we've got something we'd like you to interview for. What do you think? And I said, well, I would really, you know, appreciate it. You know, looking at all of the predecessors that had held the position, I thought, well, my records aren't the same. So I was, you know, there's always a portion of self-confidence you have when you look at, okay, what's the competition out there? What's that like? But then what's the need at the same time? And so I made some calls and talked to senior leaders. And when they told me about the direction that the Air Force was taking EPME, and then why I was being asked, then I would once hired to come into it, was really to help make this shift to bring an operational focus and really, to AETC to carry the torch, really to be ahead as a thought leader of certain things for our airmen. And that would have been, you know, something that I reflect on now. And as I went through the interview process with the former Barnes Center commander, you know, Colonel Babcock, asked a lot of direct questions about where I would see things going and what would the force receive as an impact, you know, if you were to change something in the curricula, and how would you create better airmen first that are then plugged into the joint environment to meet the concepts of, you know, AF4Gen and to embody multi-capable airmen as both an approach and a mindset, and then as a training aspect for how we fight, protect, and project, you know, air power. And we kind of walk through a lot of these things. And next thing you know, I get hired.
Yeah, so. I was going to say, I know we get you going on this topic, man. It's going to be another 30 minutes.
That's exactly right.
This is, you know, you have a true passion for this. And, you know, I do think, you know, to your kind of point, you know, you start looking at your predecessors, those who came before you.
Yeah, a lot of great men and women that.
Yeah, no, I mean, the legacy of that organization, the significance of it for our you know, institution, for the enlisted force. I mean, it's a big deal. You know, so you don't get that call by accident. I think another key part for somebody listening in is, and I think our Air Force is still figuring this out, you know, this thing we, you know, called talent management. And so traditionally that position was reserved for somebody who had been a graduated command chief, had a, you know, successful tour as a command chief, one, if not multiple tours. And you really did kind of break the paradigm to say, hey, you know, we have this chief on the board who has some pretty, pretty significant background for exactly what this institution needs. And so I think there's two aspects. I think that it's good on the institution to say, hey, let's not fence off potentially the right chief, right? And you still had to interview, still had to go through all that process. Yep. Nothing was ever given. But then I have to give yourself kind of also the personal side where you didn't resist to do what the institution was asking you to do. You know, as I reflect on my time as a newer chief, I got asked to say, hey, what do you think about this job? And I did the same thing. I looked at who came before me, and I honestly backed away. You know, I was like, hey, I don't have that experience. I haven't done that before. And then, you know, I had a friend of mine who was kind of like, hey, man, like, you should have let the institution decide. Your job is just to say, I'm willing to do it.
Right? Yeah.
I'm willing to step my hat in the arena. And so I think really great on you to say, hey, if you'll have me, you know, I'm willing. And I think, you know, certainly kind of fast forward, you know, to where we are now, particularly the focus on joint and international. I mean, I've seen a lot of that flourish in your time there, particularly the, you mentioned rigor earlier, really increasing, because we know that, you know, what we're asking our senior NCOs, particularly, you know, and people hear things about mission command, but they don't really kind of understand the significance of what we'll be asking really captain and E7 or E8 led teams to go do. Right. And to go execute, which is in some ways a return to old. I would even say the Green Berets you sat down with would say, hey, we did some stuff like that before.
Yeah.
But I think at the same time, we're really trying to focus on preparing people for education to do the hard things that they may ask to do, you know? And so, I know we've been talking for a little bit. I don't know what you want to share kind of your time and experience at the Academy.
Yeah. So, you know, I think about the point that our Air Force is in, and how do we get men and women to think of decentralized control for decentralized execution, because every AFSC is different. And I recognize that, you know, coming from a very small AFSC, having to think broader earlier, and then obviously my unique mindset and career path, you know, understanding of how do we help every airman get to the point where they can understand a little bit more of plugging into the greater formation. So whether that's the Air Task Forces as they stand up, You mentioned it heavily of, you know, it will be that master or that senior that's that SEL with that junior field grade officer. And as an example, like mission command principles often are very, for our Air Force, crew centric, or they're centric with, let's say, a team on an ops floor, or our defender formation or EOD or any of our Air Force Special Warfare fields can embody a lot of those things easily. They're just natural in what they do. And it's not to say that the single technician role isn't still value added.
Right, we're not sacrificing technical capability, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's a big shift in mindset of both the onus on, hey, you're going to have to be accountable, you know, for these areas through the 4-gen cycle so that all of your airmen are able to go forward and do things through the premise of airmanship when you may not have had, you know, the opportunity to be around items in the domain, right?
Yep.
And so this is something where, as I look over the last year of my time at the academy, you know, our team has done an amazing job of.
You do have an all-star cast over there.
We do. So everything from we've produced SELs out for other organizations, but the academy is also, you know, leading the way with the foundations content, the 300, 500, 700, and 900 that'll be rolling out. So when you talk about the touch points in an airman's career, being around the men and women that are leading that for the total force is really neat to see, because we are a true swath of all AFSC series, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 onward that are represented, and to watch the discovery from our airmen that come through, whether they've been in the Air Force, and we've got some students that'll come in at 11, 12 years in service, brand new senior master sergeant, that's very early in their, you know, life and career, and they may be scared of what they're about to approach as far as a job role, and they may be alongside a brother or sister that's 22, 23, 24 years in service, active guard or reserve, and a seasoned brand new senior.
Yep.
So they've been a senior NCO for a long time, and how do you get, you know, all to get to the finish line at the same time, and then return back to their formations? So really just done some, I would say the team's done some amazing things at making an operationally focused curriculum, because if you go back to the history of the organization, really about in the early 1970s, post-Vietnam, you get 73, 74, from the stand-up of CCF, the initial classes that came through the Senior NCO Academy, we just had our 50th anniversary last year, how much it's evolved, and as opposed to the sister services, which have all evolved as well, the Air Force was really heavy on education early and often. And so now we see men and women are at that inflection point of how do I translate what I've learned in tactical experience to have some of that operational exposure, because they're going to have to make decisions in the battle space that are for influence. They're for the aspects of strategic competition. One thing I tell our students often is at the end of the day when, like this year, we're in an election year.
Yep.
And politics, can be difficult for a senior NCO, for a commander to deal with in their organization. And so I tell the students of every single class, I said, regardless of presidential administration, whether it's a Republican or Democrat or, you know, an independent candidate, and what they propose, things rang true. It's peace, security, prosperity, values, and international order. And those items are going to ebb and flow throughout, and it's just how we use that makeup of tools that then you as an airman have to find out, do I need to be the best supporting actor for the other elements of national power? Are you buying time and space for the State Department to do something, or time and space for an economic impact to take place? So when air power is called upon, you're the best that you can possibly be. I think that's the premise of what our instructors are doing now, is getting men and women ready for strategic competition. What is winning? Winning is staying in the game. Winning is playing the long game and continuing to come back and come back again and come back again and do it well as only our airmen can. Blending their unique expertise, while also at the same time beginning to lead in greater joint formations.
Yeah, Alex, I have to say, man, I really love seeing you and your team continue to do. Like, you talk about what is winning. I know. I think we don't talk about it enough, and I love to see that you guys are really understanding and helping others understand exactly what that is, what that means, and particularly. I think you even talk about it. It's the values we have as Americans and what we uphold and defend. That's what we can't just look beyond that, right? It's not it's not war for the sake of war, military for the sake of, like, it's not the movie stuff. It's really, you know, it connects to the oaths we all take in that deeper sense. And so sometimes I think it's in the nature of a world, you can get caught up in these currents that sway one way or the other. But at the end of the day, you know, America needs to be able to look to us and be confident that we're ready to go. I do want to give you an opportunity. You know, you will be transitioning this summer. You know, and I, this isn't a going away message or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, the reward for good work is going to be more work. But I didn't know if you had any things you want to share. I'd really just thank you, man, for sitting down today and sharing your journey. You know, as an airman, as a service member, as a son, as a husband, I think a lot of people are going to tune in and take a lot from this. You know, I got to know more about you today, and it really just, man, it just makes me smile. And I can't match that beautiful smile you have as well. You guys can look on his bio and see for yourself. But I just appreciate, man, what you bring to our Air Force. I appreciate how you lead, and I appreciate being the leader and the brother you are. But, man, over to you or anything you want to kind of close out with.
Yeah, so, Blaze, you know, thanks so much for allowing me to come and kind of share my story. Often it's something I would keep guarded to myself and not share, but I'm really at that point in my career where I think about, you know, those knowledge and lessons learned that people have. If you don't share it with others, how are they going to grow, you know, as a result? You know, for me, that was just a chapter of my life. It was an experience, yet it had so much to do with defining me about who I would become as an airman. And so I never want to lose that thought and that perspective, because it didn't define the rest of my career. It just gave me a different outlook and a perspective. And with that, I owe so much to the community inside, not only Air Force Special Operations Command, but Special Tactics, the ground operators, the young officers and enlisted team sergeants, the ones that raised me, grew me, and taught me how to be not only a good operator, but a good NCO, a good airman. You know, as a result, they were always focused on the aspect of a common colloquialism we hear in the military of mission first, people always, you know, of team first and operator always, and focusing on our families and the outreach in that portion. And so I think of that as how I view everything now. And as I look on my career, I would say that you're always going to face change. And that's something that I've had to recognize, where I came in to go into meteorology knowing that I would become this combat weatherman, knowing that, oh my goodness, it now changed to Special Operations Weather Team. And then up until about 5 years ago is when the crew field transitioned to Special Reconnaissance. And at that point, I had aged out. If I'm physically out of the field already, now I find myself as a senior enlisted leader having to advise others on the beret that I represent, on the community that I represent, talking about the capability, but I'm not physically doing those actions anymore. And so I would offer to anybody that the environment's going to change around you. And I had to take my mindset from being in environmental reconnaissance to, okay, how do I advocate for tracking and targeting and locating of the enemy and recruitment and staging, onward integration of forces, still giving a battlefield commander updates, but now thinking, okay, how would a senior airman do the last tactical mile for SR, for cyber and for kinetic effects so that air power goes forward? It was a lot of the same things that I did as a senior airman. And so now I'm just sitting as a chief thinking, okay, how do I advocate for those airmen? And so I would just say that every airman's going to find themselves in a position of change. Do I consider myself a special reconnaissance man? By name of my AFSC now and what I represent, but at my heart, I was raised inside the special tactics community of operators of all kinds. So now I think about, how do I advocate and tell the story? And really, I would just offer airmen out there to be ready for anything. The Air Force is a kind of journey where you may not get to choose your own adventure. You may have had a say in what your AFSC was and your daily duties and your performance is upon you. That's the equality of the opportunity to do your absolute best. But it really comes down to, what do you want, you know, out of this journey? What will you represent? Of not the pieces of flair that you collect on your uniform or the rank that you collect, but how will you be known as an airman, as a person, as a spouse, as a loved one? What is the legacy that you're going to lead? Because it's the aspect of showing up every day and continuing to do so that I think is what made me successful over time. It was that grit to continue, but at the same time, having a heart for service. Because when you're serving everyone else, you will find that the enjoyment then comes back in the act of service.
Thanks, Alex.
Appreciate it, Blaze.